Gerald soon demonstrated an even stronger religious devotion than his parents. He left school as a teenager to become a traveling minister and was wildly successful as a public speaker. By 21, he was reportedly being sought after by churches all over the Midwest, but decided to settle back in Wichita. In 1925, he assembled a group of fellow fundamentalist ministers to form Defenders of the Christian Faith, a group composed of ministers and congregations who saw themselves engaged in a war against evolution, atheism, intemperance, and that theological monstrosity so terribly misnamed modernism. The organization's official newspaper, The Defender, would become the platform for Winrod's ideas. Crowds at his sermons began to swell, and his trademark look, a well-groomed mustache, balding head, and dark suit, made him instantly recognizable. His powerful diatribes in favor of prohibition and against the theory of evolution made him a regional celebrity. By 1932, more than 60,000 people had purchased subscriptions to The Defender, and Winrod had expanded to publishing short books. Like Coughlin, Winrod began to dabble in politics as the Great Depression unfolded. At some point, he stumbled across the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, one of the most notorious anti-Semitic conspiracy theories of all time. The protocols purported to reveal the existence of an international Jewish plot to control finance and politics by spreading discord throughout the Gentile world. Its American fans included Henry Ford, who subsidized mass distribution of the text. Like many anti-Semites, Winrod now believed the text had predicted the Depression and revealed that Jews were responsible for it. While Coughlin had only dabbled with this message before 1936 in his rants about bankers, Winrod embraced it head-on. For the Kansas preacher, Roosevelt's failure to smash up the international banks became proof of his connections to the Jewish conspiracy. The New Deal was also a Jewish plot. Winrod soon established a second publication, The Revealer, that was loaded with purely political commentary and revealing Jewish machinations. Winrod's discovery of the protocols started him down the road to becoming one of Hitler's key American friends. By the mid-1930s, he was expressing admiration for the Führer in print and proclaimed that the Nazi regime was protecting Christian churches from Jewish and communist threats. In 1935, Winrod traveled to Germany for a three-month stay and met representatives of the German government that included Nazi ideologue and propaganda publisher Julius Streicher. The trip was arranged in part by a Nazi agent in the United States who recognized Winrod's potential to help the German cause. Returning to the United States, Winrod embarked on a nationwide speaking tour to talk up Hitler's government. The Führer was, Winrod claimed, a leader, law-abiding, living quietly in a Christian way that not even his enemies can find fault with. He is a true man's man, and the worst that can be said of him is when he sets himself about a task, he does it most thoroughly and conscientiously. Germany, he continued, is today the best country in Europe. Months later, Winrod favorably compared Hitler to Reformation leader Martin Luther. Both the Defender and the Revealer soon took on a heavily anti-communist, pro-German slant. Defender circulation soared to more than 100,000 by 1937. States with the highest number of subscribers included California, Pennsylvania, and Illinois, illustrating Winrod's nationwide appeal. This was still about half of Coughlin's social justice following, but Winrod's increasingly pro-Nazi remarks were quickly gaining him a national following. Winrod was far from shy about his connections to the Third Reich. He frequently received Nazi propaganda material and published translated versions of Nazi propaganda. In return, the German press began quoting Winrod as a leading American anti-Semite. One German newspaper went so far as to brand him the American Striker. Relishing his newfound fame, Winrod started to plan how he could translate this success into political power. First, though, he would have to solidify his status with the Germans to ensure their continued support. The most obvious obstacle was that Winrod himself did not speak German. To overcome this hurdle, he quietly secured the services of John J. Croker, an anti-Semitic Kansas Mennonite who spoke fluent German, in addition to Russian and several other languages. Croker was a refugee from the Tsarist Empire who had fled the Russian Civil War through Berlin in 1920. His personal obsession with the Third Reich would eventually lead him to abandon his family in Kansas and return to Hitler's Germany. In mid-1937, Croker began contributing articles to The Defender under the pen name John Jacob. Much of his work was oriented toward exposing the Jewish origins of communist revolutions using secret sources. Croker thus provided Winrod with critical material to support his growing anti-Semitic campaign. As Coughlin's political movement temporarily crashed and burned after the 1936 election, Winrod saw an opportunity to pick up the pieces for his own benefit. One of Kansas's two Senate seats was coming up for re-election in 1938. It was held by weak incumbent Democrat George McGill, who was expected to lose as the state was swinging to the GOP. At the time of writing, no Democrat has been elected senator in Kansas since McGill. Winrod's plan was to secure the Republican nomination and ride the GOP electoral wave into the Senate. From there, he would have almost certainly been eyeing the presidency in 1940 or 1944. It was not a bad plan, and Winrod initially seemed to have the upper hand in the campaign. Pulling another card from Coughlin's playbook, Winrod now developed a regional radio presence to spread his political message. He regularly bought time and appeared on WIBW, Topeka, and KCKN, Kansas City, among other stations. In March 1938, Winrod delivered a series of strident radio addresses denouncing the country's economic system in his usual conspiratorial language. Perhaps you have thought the United States Congress controls the nation's money. This most decidedly is not the case. He denounced Roosevelt for criticizing Italy, Japan, and Germany, without attacking the Soviet Union equally. Opposition to fascism and supposed support for communism, he warned, meant that every conceivable attempt will be made in coming months to pull us into another Holocaust. War never pays. By the time the election rolled around, Winrod was addressing voters over the radio twice a day. Crowds flocked to his speeches and rallies as he barnstormed around the state. Winrod also showed political shrewdness by moderating his anti-Semitism on the campaign trail, though his comments about groups exerting secret control over the economy were a dog whistle for anti-Semites. Yet his past views and statements still caught up with him. In 1937, a longtime opponent, Reverend Leon M. Burkhead of Kansas City, Missouri, founded a group called Friends of Democracy to fight fascist influence, and quickly made Winrod one of his primary targets. By 1938, Burkhead and his allies were publicly accusing Winrod of being a Nazi sympathizer and receiving campaign funds from Germany. Burkhead even claimed to have personally seen Winrod's name on a list of Americans expected to help the Nazis in the event of war during a visit to Germany. The unfolding political fiasco in Kansas soon gained the attention of Washington's power brokers. With the August GOP primary approaching, Roosevelt made a personal inquiry into the race. Writing to progressive leader and Kansas newspaper editor William Allen White, Roosevelt asked whether it was true that Winrod is openly a fascist, and in addition to that, is showing KKK tendencies. Proclaiming himself to have been afraid of Winrod for several years, White reported that the preacher had been selling Jew-baiting literature and had all the money he needs for the radio, which is expensive. In addition, he speaks well, either on the radio or to an audience, and is a strapping, handsome, smooth-talking man, much like a medicine vendor or a soap peddler. Barring a dramatic intervention from within the Republican Party, White predicted he will win in the primary and probably end up in the Senate. The national media now got wind of the Nazi who might end up in Washington. References to Winrod running on a straight fascist ticket started to show up in newspapers around the country. In early July, the Chicago Times headlined a story about Winrod by describing him as an arch-fascist and lamented that Republican leaders had not intervened in the race. The New York Times described Winrod as an authentic voice of religious, racial, and social bigotry, and called for his defeat in the hope that it would discourage Winrodism from coast to coast. By Election Day, The Times was reporting that Winrod had been branded as the Kansas Nazi. Pressure began mounting on GOP leaders to do something. Weeks after the press frenzy began, Republican National Committee Chairman John D. Hamilton, a former Kansan himself, denounced Winrod in an open letter to supporters. A Winrod victory, he wrote, would encourage intolerance in Kansas that was reminiscent of the Ku Klux Klan's heyday in the 1920s. We have all been shocked by the manifestations of intolerance growing in the world elsewhere, and should be more than shocked at its appearance on our very doorstep, and therefore doubly vigilant, he wrote. If this was not enough, he concluded, may I ask them to consider the possible disastrous effects which his nomination would have upon the entire state and local Republican tickets in November. The Kansas GOP now found the political will to unite against Winrod. Mainstream Republicans convinced former Governor Clyde Reed to enter the race and coalesced around his candidacy. He went on to win the primary and the general election handily. Winrod received a mere 53,000 votes in the primary, putting him in humiliating third place. The Times reported that the six counties he won, out of 105 total, were centers of Ku Klux Klan activities when the Klan made an unsuccessful effort to gain dominance in this state in the 1920s. Winrod blamed the defeat on an organized conspiracy, a dastardly program of persecution and falsehood, engineered by the very interests which are now carrying us toward war. In other words, he thought the Jews were responsible. Winrod's bid for the Senate was the closest any of Hitler's American friends would come to a direct electoral mandate. Without the intervention of the Kansas GOP, it is likely he would have won the primary and potentially gone on to win the seat. This was far further than the machinations of the German-American Bund or the Silver Legion had ever propelled their chosen candidates. It also gave Winrod national notoriety. In November, the Kansan was scheduled to give a series of sermons at evangelist Amy Semple McPherson's famous Angelus Temple in Los Angeles. The announcement of his visit to California was greeted not with the adulatory crowds he had found in the past, but instead with protests and threats of violence. The Hollywood Anti-Nazi League contacted McPherson directly to protest the appearance of an advocate of fascist dictatorship. Bomb threats were phoned to the temple on the day of Winrod's first appearance, but failed to deter the 4,500 attendees who turned up for the event. I know that I am not a Nazi, he told the crowd. I know that I have never received a single dollar from Germany. No doubt to the relief of many, Winrod announced shortly after that he was canceling his remaining sermons at the temple and quietly slunk out of California. By mid-1938, anti-Semitism was increasing across the country, no doubt fanned in part by the antics of Winrod, Smith, and their fellow travelers. A fortune poll in August 1938 found that 32% of respondents believed there was growing hostility toward Jews. In March 1939, that number had grown to 45% in a nationwide Gallup poll. 4 months later, a full 32% of Americans told Fortune that the government should take steps to prevent Jews from getting too much power in the business world, and 10% said Jews should be deported outright to some new homeland as fast as it can be done without inhumanity. This latter number meant roughly 13 million Americans believed Jews should be removed from the United States. Always the showman, Father Coughlin decided to jump directly on this bandwagon of prejudice. In early 1938, he launched a new series of broadcasts in which he leveled attacks on Wall Street bankers and other targets who all had Jewish last names. Social Justice began publishing excerpts from the protocols and translated speeches by Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. Coughlin was now modeling his actions on Winrod's activities. Things only grew darker from there. In January 1938, Coughlin announced the formation of two new political organizations to spread his message. The first, called the Million League, fell flat almost immediately. The second, the Christian Front, would soon make Coughlin even more notorious. The Front was organized into local chapters and was tasked with fighting the spread of communism and the insidious enemy in the United States. Jews were excluded from membership, and local chapters began organizing buy-Christian-only campaigns to intimidate the patrons of Jewish shops. Members began arming themselves and practiced shooting at gun ranges and sports clubs. Christian Front followers became known for beating up Jews in the streets of American cities and proclaimed themselves to be Father Coughlin's brown shirts. In April 1939, hundreds of people attacked newsboys selling social justice on the streets of New York, leading to a brawl with Christian Front thugs who came to their aid. Whispers began to spread around the city that Irish-American Catholics and the New York City Police Department were deliberately letting the violence unfold and refused to take action against the Christian Front. Coughlin himself remained silent as the violence grew, but continued to voice general support for the organization. Critics began acidly referring to his church, the Shrine of the Little Flower, as the Shrine of the Little Fuhrer. Predictably, Coughlin's relationship with the Nazis only grew stronger as a result of these developments. The anti-Semitic rag Der Stürmer praised Coughlin as one of the only Americans with the courage to speak his conviction that National Socialism is right. German Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop reportedly asked a Coughlin aide in 1939 to give my regards to Father Coughlin. I have a high regard for him. Other Nazi officials later reported that Coughlin was discussed with extraordinary frequency in the foreign ministry. The priest even attained popularity with the German public. An American student studying in the Reich later recalled a beer hall patron remarking that Coughlin would make a good pope following the death of Pius XI in 1939. The young American and his friends quickly dropped the subject rather than risk a barroom brawl. Despite his growing popularity in both the United States and the Reich, the German embassy in Washington deliberately kept Coughlin at arm's length. As former embassy first secretary and spymaster Heribert von Strempel told post-war interrogators, I was very much against the embassy having any relation with Father Coughlin, because such relations would have been used to smear him in order to destroy his integrity. I believed he would be more effective to be left alone. There was some evidence of collusion, however. Nazi propaganda agent George Sylvester Virek, discussed later, contributed several pieces to Social Justice and met Coughlin in New York. The priest was effectively doing business directly with the Third Reich, though both sides were careful to keep their arrangement quiet. Winrod had been once again overshadowed by Coughlin after the creation of the Christian Front. Still commanding a substantial audience, however, the Kansas preacher tried to mobilize his followers in a similar direction. In early 1939, he tasked John Croker with researching and preparing articles exploring the question of Jewish influence on Germany's religious developments. Sensing the direction wider events were taking, Croker began to push Winrod to take a stand, not just in favor of Germany, but also against U.S. intervention in a future war. He told Winrod the Defender should be used to soften American feelings toward Germany in an effort to subvert a future war effort. If you'll raise the flag against bloodshed now, and high, you'll launch the greatest battle you ever did, Croker told Winrod in April 1939. It's a battle for Christ's kingdom, even if we do talk mostly about lives, wives, and money. The benefits of a dedicated peace effort, he continued, might not be felt until a conflict actually began. If we are late, the campaign will considerably shorten the war because people will enter it with doubts in the backs of their minds. If we warn the people before a war is on, the struggle for control at home afterwards will be half won. The materials Croker proposed using included Mein Kampf and information provided directly by the office of Ernst Bohler, the British-born head of the foreign organization of the Nazi Party. This arguably subversive piece would never be written. The following month, Croker told Winrod that he was going to Germany on a scholarship provided by the Association for German Cultural Relations Abroad. This was theoretically a cultural education organization that helped Germans abroad reconnect with their heritage. In reality, it was a recruiting mechanism for potential spies who could be returned to their home countries. The Reich had clearly identified Kroeker as a potential agent they could return to the United States at a future date. Kroeker quietly left Kansas for the Reich, where he would remain until the end of the war. Winrod seems to have hardly missed the departure of his collaborator and continued to push the anti-war, pro-German line. When war broke out in September 1939, Winrod encouraged prayer from his followers and warned of sinister agencies and a hidden hand that was trying to pull us into the European Holocaust. Coughlin and Winrod now both turned their attention to encouraging American non-intervention in the European war. Coughlin argued that the war was a clash of competing capitalist interests, not a fight to save Europe from the barbarism of Nazi domination. He praised Hitler openly and attacked Roosevelt. Winrod's message was similar. Less than a month before Pearl Harbor, he was still arguing that the European war was raging because a reaction has developed in the old world against Jewish communism and Jewish capitalism. International Jewry is in a state of great perplexity, and it so happens that we have an administration at Washington which is pro-communist and Jewish-dominated. The war, he claimed, was therefore the fault of Europe's Jews and communists, and the United States should play no role. Coughlin and Winrod were both becoming increasingly difficult for the U.S. government to ignore. Martin Dyess Jr. was roundly criticized by a fellow congressman in 1942 for not having called Coughlin or Winrod to testify. Dyess retorted that it was too dangerous to subpoena clergy because if they refused to testify, they would be held in contempt and, from all over the country, there would have arisen an outcry denouncing us as being against certain religions. Instead, Dyess claimed that his committee had gathered information on Winrod and Coughlin using other methods. There was an element of truth to this. As it turned out, the Dyess committee had quietly dispatched investigators to Kansas during the 1938 Senate campaign. Winrod himself was interviewed and refused to answer questions except through his attorney. The investigation did reveal a number of interesting facts, however. A Wichita bank president reported that the KKK was backing Winrod behind the scenes. This was potentially interesting, but not the investigators' main focus. Their primary objective was to establish whether Winrod was receiving large donations that could be traced to Germany. They uncovered nothing particularly suspicious in this regard, and discovered that local opposition to Winrod was greater than had been assumed. A local radio station manager even told the detectives that he was personally opposed to Winrod's politics, but felt he had no choice but to sell him airtime because there was no legal way to prevent him from doing so. The manager had received so much negative mail from irate listeners that he was considering using static interference to make the broadcasts unlistenable. While this investigation turned up little, Winrod was certainly on the government's radar, and unlike Coughlin, his legal troubles would only grow. In 1940, a book entitled The Fifth Column Is Here listed Winrod by name as one of the Americans working to break down our psychological defenses against Hitler and Mussolini. Winrod's days of freedom were numbered. Coughlin was also on the government's radar, but was taking careful steps to cover his tracks. Christian Front violence was spreading, and in July 1939, Coughlin told listeners that he was neither the organizer nor the sponsor of the Christian Front, and moreover, that it is not becoming for me to identify myself with this organization or any other organization. This was a clever rhetorical dodge, but it fooled no one, since Coughlin had founded the group. Ill-advisedly, Coughlin now began appearing at German-American Bund meetings while paperboys distributed copies of Social Justice outside the venues. The priest was forced to deny rumors in the press that the Christian Front and the Bund, then in the midst of its final collapse, would soon be merging. In January 1940, this delicate situation boiled over. On January 7th, Coughlin delivered a radio speech in which he questioned whether democracy was actually a worse political system than dictatorship, because democracy has failed so long to function advantageously for the nation. In his mind, dictatorship would presumably do better. Less than a week later, FBI agents, led personally by Director J. Edgar Hoover, launched raids to arrest 18 members of the Christian Front's Brooklyn chapter. Press reports the next day revealed that the men had allegedly been planning the overthrow of the government of the United States. As the New York Times front page put it, it was a startling plot. Most of the men had served in the armed forces or the New York National Guard, and therefore had experience with weapons. Over the past few months, they had managed to acquire explosives, a dozen Springfield rifles, thousands of rounds of ammunition, and other small arms. Hoover dramatically announced to the press that the men had been planning to blow up bridges, seize power plants and telephone networks, and then take control of the Federal Reserve gold supply. Plans were discussed for the wholesale sabotage and blowing up of all these institutions so that a dictatorship could be set up here, similar to the Hitler dictatorship in Germany, seizing the reins of government in this country as Hitler did in Germany, Hoover told stunned reporters. Their scheme was to spread a reign of terrorism so that the authorities would become thoroughly demoralized. The group also aimed for the eradication of the Jews of the United States, he added. The fantastic notion of a program of such size being carried out by 18 men with 12 rifles and 18 bombs in a city with 18,000 well-equipped police and several regiments of United States Army regulars handy was apparently no part of their thought, the Times remarked. Regardless of how outlandish the plan may have been, the revelation sent shockwaves around the country. Left-wing critics jumped on the discovery as proof that Coughlin was a national security threat. The terrible danger of the arrests is not so much the disclosal that Coughlin's followers are cashing rifles and cordite, but that millions of unemployed, millions of those on starvation wages, millions of desperate youth who see nothing but a hopeless blank future under capitalism will turn to Father Coughlin as the only one who offers them a way out, Trotskyite leader Joseph Hansen told his followers. Coughlin himself quickly disavowed the plotters, unconvincingly claiming that he had advocated a Christian front rather than the specific Christian front involved in the conspiracy charges. Embarrassingly, it only took reporters a few days to find articles in past issues of Social Justice praising the plot leader by name. Worried a larger plot might exist, U.S. Attorney General Robert H. Jackson believed the government should make an example of the Christian fronters. He dispatched one of the government's top investigators, Assistant Attorney General O. John Roga, to oversee the inquiries and eventual prosecutions. Roga, who went by his first initial and middle name, was well on his way to becoming a Justice Department legend. After graduating from Harvard Law School at 21, he was appointed head of the department's criminal division. In that role, he was responsible for breaking up the remains of Huey Long's political machine in Louisiana after its leader's assassination. Among the men Roga sent to prison on corruption charges was Governor Richard W. Letch, Long's direct successor. Roga now turned his considerable talents to investigating Hitler's American friends, and the Christian Front would be only his first target among many. Coughlin now made the situation even worse with a serious misstep. On January 21st, he made a broadcast supporting the accused men, saying that as a fellow Christian, he had no choice but to support them until they are released or convicted. He now branded himself a friend of the accused, who was willing to take my stand beside the Christian fronters. The eventual trial of the Brooklyn Boys, as the press dubbed the Christian Front plotters, was a circus. The prosecution case relied heavily on the testimony of an FBI informant who had infiltrated the gang and recorded key conversations on the inside of his shirt sleeves, along with some audio recordings. The boys' defense attorney, a former Brooklyn judge, portrayed the prosecution as an attack on Catholicism. He claimed the recorded conversations were merely a form of youthful bragging, not a serious plot. A friendly crowd cheered the defendants as they entered the courtroom each day. The entire proceeding ended in disaster for the government. Three defendants were released early through lack of evidence, and another, bizarrely, committed suicide, apparently distraught that if convicted, he might not be able to travel to Europe and fight for Hitler. After 47 hours of deliberations, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty against 9 defendants and a mistrial against the other 5. Coughlin was overjoyed, but the victory was short-lived. The Catholic Church was increasingly worried about the impact of his activities, and the death of Bishop Gallagher had robbed Coughlin of his key supporter in the church hierarchy. Now the knives were coming out for him in earnest. In late 1938, Coughlin's superior, Bishop Mooney, warned Coughlin that his activities might be in violation of Vatican regulations. Despite the increasing pressure, Coughlin kept broadcasting throughout the 1939 and 1940 season, ending in May of that year. He simultaneously kept feeling out the limits of Mooney's tolerance with inflammatory social justice articles. The Archbishop was not pleased and resolved to keep Coughlin from engaging in politics as he had in 1936. In late 1940, it was rumored in the press that Coughlin might attempt to intervene in the upcoming presidential election by returning to the airwaves. Mooney quickly outmaneuvered him by demanding that Coughlin submit his radio scripts in advance to a church board for possible censorship. Mooney had already used this power to prevent Coughlin from delivering an anti-Semitic diatribe in February 1940, and now he threatened the priest with official church sanctions if he submitted undesirable scripts. At the same time, Coughlin's radio stations were balking under public pressure to drop his program due to its controversial content. Faced with pressure from both the public and the church, Coughlin had little choice but to abandon his broadcasting plans. Social justice would henceforth be his only public voice. The U.S. government now stepped in on this front. In March 1941, social justice was banned on military bases as a potentially subversive publication. It was a sensible move. Even the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December of that year did not change the Coughlinite party line, which now vocally blamed Roosevelt and the Jews for precipitating the attack. Winrod took a similar stance in his own writings. There would be no brutal Nazism today had it not been for savage communism, shackled upon the nations by Jewish money power, he wrote in early 1942. The last straw for the government came in early 1942. When State Department official Adolph A. Berla requested a full FBI investigation of social justice, the inquiry quickly turned to whether Coughlin was giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. In March 1942, Coughlin had foolishly declared in a social justice article that the war had been caused by the race of Jews, rather than German aggression. The following month, the Postmaster General suspended the distribution of social justice on the grounds that it might harm military morale. Coughlin was not technically the publisher of the newspaper, and therefore could not face criminal sanctions, but he quickly offered to testify before a grand jury if distribution of the newspaper resumed. Creating a martyr of Coughlin and potentially alienating millions of Catholics was seen as too great a risk in the middle of a war, so the government declined the offer. Still, social justice and Coughlin were finished. Mooney sent Coughlin a letter of rebuke for violating his past promises to abstain from politics. The radio priest dropped out of the public eye and resumed his career as a parish priest, though there were dark rumors about his past activities and future plans that would follow him for the rest of his life. Coughlin's forced silencing by Mooney and the U.S. government likely saved him from a worse fate. Since May 1941, a federal grand jury had been quietly investigating Hitler's American friends to determine the scope of their activities and ambitions. Coughlin's departure from the political scene and his status as a Catholic priest insulated him from what was to come. But Winrod was less fortunate. In early 1942, the Dais Committee concluded that Winrod had been among the men who were intended to be part of a united fascist movement which never got going, and the claim was widely reported in the press. In July, the grand jury issued indictments against 28 people believed to be seditious and seeking to interfere with, impair, and influence the loyalty, morale, and discipline of American servicemen. Winrod's name was first on the indictment list. He turned himself in to federal authorities 4 days later. Rather than be arrested at home, the Kansas preacher paid his own train fare to Washington. The legal proceedings against him would last until well after the end of the war. While Coughlin and Winrod had captured the bulk of the public's attention, Gerald L.K. Smith was quietly biding his time. Chastened by his break with Coughlin and Townsend, he founded a group called the Committee of 1 Million to oppose Roosevelt and the New Deal. His fiery rhetoric as he traveled the country increasingly focused on the threat of communism and labor unions. He personally met Henry Ford in 1937 and claimed the industrialists convinced him that the real threat to the United States came from Jews. Smith's rhetoric now turned heavily anti-Semitic. In 1939, he moved to Detroit to be closer to the business owners who now were bankrolling his operations, allegedly including Ford. By 1941, he had made the move to non-intervention campaigning, adopting the America First label in addition to his usual anti-Roosevelt politicking. The following year, he announced a run for the U.S. Senate in Michigan on the Republican ticket. His campaign platform was the Bible and America First, and he openly called for his supporters to back Father Coughlin's ideas. The Republican Party eventually united to bury him in the GOP primary, as it had with Winrod. Smith then foolishly decided to run as a write-in candidate and received a few thousand votes in the general election. The fiasco was a major blow to his political prestige, but unlike Coughlin and Winrod, Smith would survive to become a major player in the post-war far right. For now, however, all three demagogues were out of business. Hitler's religious friends had been particularly effective at communicating with America's most disaffected citizens. While groups like the Bund and the Silver Legion were based on shared cultural heritage and bizarre mysticism, Coughlin, Winrod, and Smith rooted their messages in old-time religion and the suffering millions of Americans experienced in the Depression. Polls consistently found that Coughlin supporters were largely drawn from the urban poor in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest. The priest's message of radical economic leveling and political revolution naturally appealed to people who had lost everything and were seemingly being left behind by the government's relief measures. Similarly, Winrod's supporters were mostly farmers and rural Americans who had likewise been devastated. Winrod was essentially the Protestant repackaging of Coughlin's message, with an added element of homespun Midwestern appeal. Smith was an amalgamation of both messages. His experience with Huey Long gave him unparalleled insight into how to connect with rural audiences, but he could make the transition to urban settings as well. As the most powerful speaker of the three, Smith had the best potential to make the move into mainstream politics after the war. All three men turned to Nazi sympathies for similar reasons. Winrod thought Hitler was a Christian bulwark against Jewish communism. Coughlin believed there was an international Jewish conspiracy running the banks and the Roosevelt administration. Smith shared both views and developed a seething hatred of the president. Remarkably, Winrod and Coughlin proved to be the most politically successful of Hitler's American friends. Coughlin was a force to be reckoned with in 1936 and after, though his star was tarnished by the disastrous Lemke presidential campaign. Winrod would have likely ended up in the U.S. Senate if the Kansas Republican Party had not united against him. The United States narrowly escaped having a Nazi sympathizer elected to high office due to a combination of luck and the consciences of key power brokers in the Republican Party. In the search for an American Führer, both Coughlin and Winrod had their moment in the sun, only to be brought down by their inability to work together, and ultimately by the diligence of the U.S. government. Regardless of their failure to achieve power, Hitler's religious friends held a special influence over millions of Americans. There are few forces more powerful than religion, and these men used their authority to convert Americans to a prejudicial and hateful ideology. It is telling that the German government viewed these men as key propaganda assets in the United States and were reluctant to give them direct aid only because it might make them less effective in spreading pro-Nazi ideas. There were obvious consequences for these actions. Coughlin's superiors in the Catholic Church were outraged by his conduct and ensured he never again entered the political realm. He would live out his days in a strange combination of obscurity and infamy. Unshackled from church hierarchy, but also less protected, Winrod would be less fortunate. It would be left to Smith to carry the torch of Hitler's religious friends into the post-war world. And this he would do with enthusiasm.